Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
On what is the second day of April, which means we're almost 5 months from the last time something like today happened, where President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping talked one-on-one. Of course, the last time they did this was back in November at their summit in person in San Francisco. Today, it was just a telephone conversation, and we just got the readout from the White House. The White House statement saying that Biden and Xi had a candid and constructive discussion, discussed AI risks, efforts on climate change, raised concerns over China's support for Russia, and raised issues with unfair trade policies as well in this call. But let's get more details now. Ian Marlow covers national security and diplomacy for us here at Bloomberg in Washington. He is joining me now in studio. Ian, great to see you as always. What else do we know went down this morning on this phone call?
Yeah, I think one of the key things that's changed, I mean, there's been a sort of laundry list of things that they discussed, counter-narcotics, stuff related to fentanyl, the fentanyl crisis in the U.S., which is one thing, AI regulation, which is something that I've talked about before. One of the new things, though, that they discussed was Chinese support for Russia's economy at a time where Russia's obviously in Ukraine and that war has been dragging on, and the Russian economy has been more resilient than Western observers hoped for when they initially slapped sanctions on. So that was one thing that was brought up that I think is maybe a little bit different from when we had that conversation back in California, you know, a few months ago now. And so that's something, it's obviously a huge thing that U.S. officials are concerned about Chinese aid to Russia at this time.
Yeah. Well, and it's one thing to raise those concerns, to talk about them, but to what extent, Ian, is this talking for the sake of talking because they promised back in November that they were going to talk more, communicate more, or is real progress made on calls like this?
Yeah, so I think there's always a lot of work that goes into these leader-level calls and summits, and you've seen a sort of a gradual parade of these visits. I was on the first Blinken, Secretary of State Antony Blinken trip to China back in June, which sort of set off this rolling procession of all these cabinet secretaries going back and forth. But really, you know, we've seen a little bit of agreement on, you know, agreement to keep talking. We've seen agreement to keep talking on fentanyl. We've seen agreement to keep talking between the two militaries. But there hasn't really been too much concrete progress when it comes to, say, China dialing it back in the South China Sea. That was one of the things they talked about on this call. With tensions between China and the Philippines have risen lately. And so none of these issues are solved. It's just, I think they feel like they should be talking rather than not talking. And, before that trip back in June and before all these different summits, we were in a much different place, a much more tense place. And I think U.S. officials are confident to some extent that they've gotten to a better place, but none of the fundamentals have changed. And I think we have to be realistic about that. And I think there's always the potential for something new, a sort of, spy balloon 2.0 to upset the apple cart to some degree on this.
Well, it's a fair point. It seems that in a lot within the U.S.-China relationship, it's one step forward, two steps back, because there's a spy balloon or someone calls someone a dictator or that kind of thing. You talked about the rolling cabinet secretary visits. You, of course, were with Blinken back in June. He is expected to go back to China in the coming weeks, and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is actually expected to make a trip of her own this week. I would imagine they're going to reiterate a lot of the themes that we heard were on this call today.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, with Yellen, it's a lot of macroeconomic stability and sort of Chinese U.S. cooperation on the global economy. With Blinken's travels, he sort of brings up the sort of laundry list of things that China doesn't always want raised: Taiwan, human rights, detained Americans in China. So his visits tend to be a little bit more tense. But again, we were at a point where basically the Chinese and U.S. sides were sort of reading talking points to each other. And I think there's been enough dialogue over the past, 6 to 12 months that I think that U.S. officials feel they're in a slightly better spot, where they're slightly beyond reading talking points. They can try and make some progress on these issues, even if fundamental differences are going to be there. You know, it's a weird relationship to sort of grapple with, because, you know, fundamentally, they're competitors, the U.S. and China, but they want to be in a situation where they at least don't have something throwing the relationship, you know, up and down every couple of months, which is where we were sort of around the time Pelosi visited, Taiwan. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good point. You talk about how the U.S. has to handle a relationship with a competitor carefully, with adversaries, certainly, but so too with allies. Certainly, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has had his hands full, not just with issues like China, but Israel as well. He was on the call yesterday alongside Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, with their Israeli counterparts to talk about Rafah. We know that they have also agreed to continue those conversations moving forward. But does the U.S. feel like it's making tangible progress in influencing the decisions of the Israeli government when it comes to their military operation in Gaza?
Yeah, it sometimes seems like the U.S.-Israel relationship is more tense than the U.S.-China relationship to some extent. And again, like, whereas you have fundamental competition on the U.S.-Israel side, you have this sort of close partnership that's, you know, decades and decades old. And this war has just, you know, really turned all these things over in the U.S.-Israel relationship. You know, the U.S. is under domestic pressure. Netanyahu is under pressure of his own from the right, you know, to take a harder line on Gaza, on Hamas, and all these things. And so you have this really toxic situation where there's rising casualties in Gaza. No one thinks Israel shouldn't be doing anything about what happened on October 7th. But you end up with this situation now where the U.S. has been calling on Israel to take it easy when it comes to the conflict, try and wind the conflict down, try and strike a deal that will free the hostages and get a ceasefire. And Israel just doesn't seem to be listening. You get all these different situations where the U.S. sort of leans a little bit but doesn't want to put too much pressure on Israel and send the wrong message to Hamas. And so, you know, I was on Blinken's trip to Israel just the other week, and the day we got there, Israel's right-wing government announced that they were seizing new land in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that sort of happens time and time again. You've got signaling on both sides. You've got domestic political priorities on both sides. Both sides need to seem like they're doing something about the situation. But they're at odds. And I think the U.S. is confronting a situation where they really don't have that much leverage over Israel. They're giving aid. I think they don't feel like they can condition that aid and pull it back, like the military equipment that they keep sending to Israel.
Yeah.
Some of which is years in the making and won't be delivered until well after this war is over and the rest of it. But it's a tense situation. And I think this meeting, the fact that it was canceled initially, the in-person meeting was canceled, then it was held virtually. They're meant to be holding an in-person meeting, in the coming weeks. That's not a great sign of coordination between two close allies. And I think it's showing you the tension that's underneath that at the moment.
All right. Ian Marlow, Bloomberg senior reporter covering diplomacy and national security. Thank you so much for giving us the latest today. And now we want to take a look at how markets should be looking at all of these different geopolitical situations. Joining me now, I'm pleased to say, Terry Haynes, founder over at Pangea Policy. So, Terry, certainly there is no shortage of things to discuss on the geopolitical front, but I would first like to get your opinion on the U.S.-China relationship. Xi and Biden are talking. They did so today for the first time since November. Should investors take any solace in that communication, or is there just too much tension in this relationship still to not be hedging that kind of geopolitical risk?
Well, from my view, Kaylee, I think what ends up happening here is that markets will tend to be kind of overbuoyed by this stuff. It's always good that the leaders are talking. Everybody remembers the old Churchill line that jaw, jaw, talk, talk is better than war, war. But beyond that, I wouldn't read too much into it, frankly. It sounds from the White House like there's a laundry list and a litany of the familiar concerns. So, you know, they're talking. That's good. There's advantages for Xi to be talking. He's now put on a happier face with the United States business leaders, and it's somewhat recently. So it's somewhat to his advantage to do that. It's also in Biden's best interest to be and to look like publicly the engaged leader bringing up major United States concerns. Beyond that, I'd point out a couple of things. One is that there continues to be concerns about China's economy. And that's at least part of the reason why Secretary Yellen is engaging with the Chinese government on that. And also there's an awful lot going on when the White House name checks support for Russia, you can be sure that one of the things that's happening underneath that particular surface is checking back and forth with the Chinese on the next Western moves, which not only include potential United States aid for Ukraine, but the idea that the United States is going to, or the NATO and the G7 are going to create funds and other sorts of vehicles to support Ukraine in the overall monetary system. The United States will want that to be well understood as well. So there's a lot of things going on here underneath the surface, frankly, I think to assuage tensions as much as anything else.
Well, Terry, I'm glad you raised the issue of aid to Ukraine, because obviously we heard from House Speaker Mike Johnson over this past weekend talking about the idea that that actually could be on the floor in the form he envisions it, which potentially could include it being a loan rather than outright aid, potentially taking frozen Russian assets to help fund Ukraine's war effort. Is this going to happen? Is this something that could actually pass the House, the Senate, and get a signature from President Biden? Where would you put the odds?
Well, Speaker Johnson's an optimist, but then if you're in the speaker's chair, you should be. Your job is in part to kind of move the House as an institution forward, and he's trying to do that, and that's fundamentally what he's trying to do. I think what you've seen in the last 24, 48 hours is kind of typical Washington blowback on the speaker's proposals, but what he means to do by this, frankly, is start a serious dialogue in the House that ends to some sort of a conclusion. And if he can't get aid in the traditional sense, he's going to talk about loans. He's going to talk about seizing assets and using them from Russian oligarchs and the like. He's going to use everything he can in order to show forward movement on Ukraine aid and Ukraine support. I think that's all to the good in a geopolitical sense, because it shows really where I think the pendulum has been on Ukraine for some time, which is kind of more supportive of Ukraine, more optimistic. But he's got a long way to go. And if he gets something through the House by the end of April, I'd give him 60-65% today on that. But that's optimistic. And he's going to have to be talking to the Senate all along. So U.S. aid for Ukraine, you're looking at probably late April, early May at the earliest. But beyond that, you've also got these international vehicles that have been discussed much in recent days and reported on by Bloomberg as well.
Well, Terry, there also is the question for Mike Johnson, even if he's optimistic about his ability to actually get the aid on the floor and pass, should he be optimistic about being able to keep the gavel in hand after that, considering there is this motion to vacate from Marjorie Taylor Greene that she has threatened to act on if he does this exact thing, put Ukraine aid on the floor?
Well, that's a fair point. I think Johnson's playing a pretty complicated game. For markets, by the way, I don't... the first thing I'd say is I don't think it matters a whole lot who the House Speaker is. The spending bills have been done for the year. There will be more can kicking for the next fiscal year starting in late September, early October. So, the main business of this Congress is finished, number one. Number two, he's playing kind of an inside game with Greene and a few others, appointing Greene to the impeachment prosecutors for Mayorkas, for example, in the Senate. So there's that. And finally, this kind of little purist caucus that's been bedeviling Republican speakers for the last year and a half is not united on this one. And you've got somebody like Matt Gaetz, who was McCarthy's nemesis so far in Johnson's corner on this. So, I tend to think it's an active threat, but it's not a live bomb at this point for Johnson.
All right, Terry Haynes of Pangea Policy, always great to have you here on Bloomberg. Thank you so much for joining us. He, of course, is the founder of Pangea Policy, talking there about the idea that Congress basically has done its work. We finally got appropriations bills passed about halfway through the fiscal year. There are these questions remaining about supplemental funding, not just for allies like Ukraine, Israel, even Taiwan, but also potentially supplemental funding requests that could come in very short order from the White House to repair and rebuild the key bridge in Baltimore. Its collapse, I would remind everyone, was 1 week ago today, and the work to clear that channel, get Baltimore Port reopened, and then, of course, open up that vital conduit with a road once again to connect I-695 is only just beginning. So we'll follow that story and others, as always, here on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Broadcasting to you live, of course, from Washington, where we have to point out we are approaching the six-month mark of the war between Israel and Hamas. It's left thousands of Palestinians dead in Gaza and hundreds of thousands more on the brink of potential famine. And one organization attempting to address those needs of those that are hungry has lost seven members of its organization in an Israeli airstrike. This is part of the statement that we've gotten from World Central Kitchen. It reads, World Central Kitchen is devastated to confirm seven members of our team have been killed in an IDF strike in Gaza. The team was traveling in a deconflicted zone in two armored cars branded with the World Central Kitchen logo. It goes on to say, despite coordinating movements with the IDF, the convoy was hit as it was leaving the warehouse where the team had unloaded more than 100 tons of humanitarian food aid brought to Gaza on the maritime route. The statement goes on to say the seven killed were from Australia, Poland, the UK, a dual citizen of the US and Canada, and Palestine. And World Central Kitchen has now paused its operations in the region as a result. The IDF says it is carrying out an in-depth examination into the incident. And we also heard about this incident today from Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Here was his reaction.
The victims of yesterday's strike join a record number of humanitarian workers who have been killed in this particular conflict. These people are heroes. We've spoken directly to the Israeli government about this particular incident. We've urged a swift, a thorough, and impartial investigation to understand exactly what happened.
Joining me now for more on this is Michael Knights. He is the Washington Institute Jill and Jay Bernstein Fellow. Michael, always great to have you on the show where sometimes we have to talk about pretty difficult things. We heard from Jose Andres, the well-known chef and the founder of World Central Kitchen, who reacted to this news in a social media post, in part saying the Israeli government needs to stop this indiscriminate killing. It needs to stop restricting humanitarian aid, stop killing civilians and aid workers, and stop using food as a weapon. What, if anything, Michael, do you expect will change about any of those behaviors on the part of Israel?
Israel has no interest in these kind of stories coming out on air. It obviously undermines their war effort against Hamas. It undermines their global reputation. So they're not doing these things on purpose when it comes to, for instance, collateral damage incidents. So they'll try as hard as they can not to do this self-inflicted wound again. When it comes to the food security inside Gaza, they're already moving pretty fast to try and open up multiple access routes and try to reduce the risk of famine within Gaza.
Well, Michael, it's striking to me that we got the news of this airstrike on the same day that we were getting news reports of the U.S. preparing up to $18 billion in additional arms sales to Israel. Understanding how Israel's behavior may change is one thing, but what about the U.S.? Is there a world in which things happen to a degree at which the U.S. is no longer going to be able to condone all of Israel's behavior, no longer provide that kind of lethal aid, at least to the same degree?
That seems unlikely. The US and Israel are, for better or worse, you know, depending on your view, tied at the hip strategically. You know, the US has in the past reduced the amount of offensive weapons that are sent to a country like Saudi Arabia, and that itself is a heavy diplomatic and industrial ask for us to stop providing weapons to people who have built their militaries around our weapons and who are close partners. We did it. But it was only a temporary measure. I think with Israel, that's less likely because Israel's in the middle of what it sees as an existential war that it sees as it did not start and now it's trying to finish off. So I don't think we're going to see much change there. I mean, you know, the reality is America, you know, us, I'm a US citizen, we've blown up a lot of weddings, a lot of funerals, a lot of other things, and we did not expect our security partners to turn their backs on us when we did that. They just expected us to do better in the future.
Point taken. Michael, of course, as you talk about the war that Israel is still conducting, that they want to see through to the end, that likely will include an operation of some kind in Rafah. And we know that yesterday Israeli and U.S. officials talked about potentially what that operation could look like. We know the U.S. has concerns, but we've heard from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the last few days that he intends, the plan is, to move the more than 1 million Palestinian civilians that are in Rafah out, get them the humanitarian aid they need, then move in to attack the remaining Hamas battalions there. Can Israel actually pull that off?
Yeah, it's very likely that Israel is going to do a kind of clearance operation in the Rafah area, what they call the Philadelphia corridor along the Egyptian border, where they'll want to destroy as many of the long-term tunnels that link Egypt to Israel as possible, to aid with a kind of permanent defeat of Hamas as a military organization. The question is really down to the details now. So it's about when you bring people out of Rafah, do you do biometric scanning of them to ensure that there's no known terrorists amongst them, or indeed hostages being brought out amongst them, being smuggled out? So we're really down into the weedy details of exactly how that should be done. And that will take a couple of months, but the Israelis are not in a hurry.
Well, in the meantime, it's worth noting that Israel hasn't just been focusing exclusively on Hamas. Reportedly, they struck directly Iran's embassy in Syria, killing more than a dozen members of Iranian military personnel, including reportedly two generals. Iran is now vowing revenge on Israel after blaming it for that strike. The Supreme Leader said, and this is a quote, "Israel will be punished. We will make them regret their crime." What could that look like, Michael? How concerned should we be about escalation here?
Well, this was a really heavy hit for the Iranians. We had 11 killed, and amongst those were the three highest, the most senior Iranian paramilitary officers. They're equivalent of the CIA, really. The three most senior officers they have in the Syria-Lebanon area were all killed, along with their key staff officers. So for the Israelis, this was a tremendous piece of targeting, and struck a military attaché's office off to the side of the Iranian embassy. Now, the Iranians always say they're going to hit back hard. Generally speaking, they don't. After the US or the Israelis kill one of their senior officers, they make sure that all the other outstations are well protected. They withdraw people who are vulnerable and might get hit next. They prepare their move, and then at some point they'll probably go make an Israeli consulate blow up somewhere, or they'll try to. But they generally, again, they don't rush it. They wait until the moment is right for them, and then they usually strike back in a way that does not require the Israelis to then escalate even more.
But that's Iran specifically, Michael. What about actions its proxies could take? Not just thinking of Hamas here, but Hezbollah, for example.
Yeah, excellent point. So the proxies, when it comes to things that will draw a response against Iran directly, the proxies are very mindful of Iran's overall security. Hezbollah itself is very mindful of not doing anything that will draw the Israelis into a major ground forces incursion or invasion of southern Lebanon. So the Israelis are calculating that all the proxies out there are doing as much as they can do, like the Houthis in the Red Sea or the Iraqis, or they are concerned about escalation to the extent where they will not react to this. That's why the Israelis keep pushing their luck with more and more devastating strikes on Iranian leadership figures inside Syria, Lebanon, and potentially other places.
So finally, Michael, in our final minute here, would you say that the odds of another front opening up in this war are higher or lower than they were yesterday before this news?
They're higher because now we have a sudden burst of emotion within the Iranian leadership. But not significantly higher. You know, the reality is if Israel goes into Lebanon, it'll probably go in next year. And right now, the conflict is slowly de-escalating and stretching out.
All right, Michael Knights, it's always great to have you here on Balance of Power with your expertise. We really appreciate you joining us. Michael Knights, of course, the Washington Institute, Jill and Jay Bernstein Fellow, as we keep an eye on what is happening in Israel. And again, the death of seven humanitarian aid workers working on behalf of World Central Kitchen, which has now paused its operations in the region. We will see what more we hear from the Israeli investigation into the strike that killed them. We'll have much more on that story and others throughout the hour here on Balance of Power.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Very happy Tuesday to you. A Tuesday, of course, which isn't just any Tuesday. It's also primary day in a handful of states, as I mentioned, Wisconsin included, as well as Rhode Island, New York, and Connecticut. But there is the question of whether any of these primaries actually matter much at all when Donald Trump and Joe Biden already have all but locked up the respective nominations for their parties. So what, if anything, could we actually learn from the contest taking place today? Bloomberg's Nancy Cook, who covers national politics for us, is joining me here in our Washington studio. So, Nancy, are there any states today that could actually be interesting, or is just nothing really that interesting? It is interesting as a relative term in the 2024 presidential election cycle.
Well, I think what's interesting about the primaries today is just, you know, obviously we know who both of the nominees are, but we can still look at sort of the level of support. It gives us a chance to look at the level of support for the candidates in these key states. And so to sort of get a sense of like how people are doing with all these different demographic groups who, you know, they'll really need to court ahead of the 2024 election. So I would put white suburban women in that category. Mm-hmm. Black voters, Hispanic voters, these are the groups that are really going to be up for grabs that both Trump and Biden are really going after.
Well, and there's the question of young voters, too, mm-hmm. which could be potentially problematic for Biden, considering there is a movement in Wisconsin in particular, mm-hmm. one of these key swing states, to vote uninstructed on the Democratic ballot instead of for him. This is a protest over the administration's policy of supporting Israel despite what's happening in Gaza. They want 20,000 voters to vote uninstructed, roughly the margin of victory for Biden over Trump in 2020. How worried is the Biden campaign about that at this point?
I think the Biden campaign is stressed out about that. I think that there is real blowback for the way that Biden has been handling Israel. There is a real sense of outrage among young voters about how he is handling things with Gaza. And I think that there is a sense, you know, the election in November is going to be so close mm-hmm. that even if you have people who don't necessarily, if young voters don't necessarily vote for Trump, but they just stay home, that alone could cost Biden the election. And so these primaries and sort of what the turnout looks like is also very instructive for what both campaigns are up against.
Well, speaking of both campaigns, the other campaign, the Trump campaign, is on the move today. He is in Wisconsin as well as in Michigan, making two stops to talk about the border in what are not exactly border states, at least certainly not southern border states. How significant is it that he's choosing these places to go and bringing this message?
Well, I think that the Trump campaign really sees immigration as one of the key things that they're going to talk about, you know, heading into 2024. We're seeing Democrats sort of use abortion in the same way. They see it as a major vulnerability for Biden, something that they feel like he hasn't been able to handle, sort of dealing with the southern border well. And people are really outraged by it. Trump has also really been seizing on some of the crimes that have happened recently mm-hmm. with undocumented immigrants and sort of using that as an example of this tough on crime, tough on immigration message. And I think that it's something that he'll really continue to play up.
Well, of course, these events today are some of only a handful that we've seen over the course of the last month. Since Super Tuesday, when effectively the race became over for the Republican nomination, he's only had two events prior to today. Is this just a financial question to the extent to which a campaign that is having a greater difficulty pulling in money from donors and having to shell out a lot for legal fees as well? Is he going to be able to campaign to the same extent that President Biden is when he swung through a multitude of swing states since his State of the Union that same week?
Well, you have to remember that Trump faced a primary, and so he had to do a lot more traveling from January, February, and March than Biden did, when Biden was mostly dormant and at the White House, still being president, but sort of not doing this raft of visits. And so I think the way that the Trump campaign views it is, for the spring. I don't think that we're going to see him doing as many of these rallies. You know, he's facing a lot of court cases. I think their strategy is we don't want to spend a ton of money doing a bunch of rallies this spring. We want to save that money for the summer and fall when it's going to matter more. They are at a financial disadvantage, as you said, compared to Biden. And I think that they really want to conserve that cash. And in the meantime, the Trump team has really been focused on trying to raise more money to match what the Democrats have, and also just reorganizing the RNC, sort of taking this moment to, now that he's the nominee, to kind of figure out how they want to move forward and what their strategy in the battleground states is going to be.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that Trump does have the benefit of a lot of free earned media as well, who covers each and every appearance at courthouses, in which he can kind of use it almost as a campaign stop. It's an ability to speak to voters about the wrongs that he feels have been done to him through the Department of Justice, to whatever degree of merit they may have. Nancy Cook, thank you so much, as always. Bloomberg National Politics reporter joining me today. Really appreciate it. And of course, as Nancy and I discussed, that uninstructed vote effort in Wisconsin, that does come back to the administration's policy surrounding Israel, as there is an ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. And some of the latest news we have received on that front came from World Central Kitchen. It's a humanitarian aid group working to get aid to those who need it, the thousands of hungry Palestinian civilians in Gaza. But they lost 7 members of that group in an Israeli strike yesterday. In part, the statement from World Central Kitchen reads that the 7 killed were from Australia, Poland, the United Kingdom, a dual citizen of the U.S. and Canada, and Palestine. World Central Kitchen has paused operations in the region. And we heard from Jose Andres, who is the founder of World Central Kitchen, and of course, a famous chef as well, who said that the Israeli government needs to stop this indiscriminate killing. We also heard from the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken about this earlier today. This is what he said.
The victims of yesterday's strike join a record number of humanitarian workers who have been killed in this particular conflict. These people are heroes. We've spoken directly to the Israeli government about this particular incident. We've urged a swift, a thorough, an impartial investigation to understand exactly what happened.
Joining me now for more on this is James Jeffrey. He is Wilson Center Chair of the Middle East Program and former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Turkey. Ambassador, thank you so much for being here on Bloomberg Television and Radio. On the same day that we get news of 7 aid workers being killed in an IDF strike, we also got news of potentially billions of dollars and more arms sales that the U.S. could make to Israel. How much longer is this going to be a pattern of behavior? No matter what happens in Gaza, no matter who it happens to, the U.S. is still standing behind the Israeli government.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. This is a terribly tough situation for the U.S. government to be in because of 3 things. First, Israel is in an existential fight for the first time in 50 years, and this is a fight broadly throughout the region that the United States needs to have Israel and its other allies win against not just Hamas, but Iran, Hezbollah, and the Houthis closing down the Red Sea. Second, Israel needs to do much more immediately to enable the flow, the flood of humanitarian assistance into Gaza and take much more care, what we call more restrictive combat rules of engagement, to avoid new attacks on humanitarian workers, or for that matter, civilians of any sort, in this very difficult fight. But the third point, which you didn't hear Blinken say, is that for Israel to do this, and I advocate it should, we all have to take into consideration this will result in more Israeli soldiers killed in a longer battle. That is, we've seen this in the fight against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, when we tightened rules of engagement. We lost, not us, but the Iraqi and Syrian allies lost far more forces. So we released them in 2017 and 18 in Syria. And the New York Times is now looking into that.
Okay, so there could be a lot of loss all around, not just of civilian life, but potentially the lives of members of the Israeli military as well. To go back, Ambassador, to your point about this being existential for Israel, are we at a point now, 6 months into this conflict, where this is also existential for the Palestinian people? We're not just talking about tens of thousands killed, but potentially hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions of people who could face imminent famine if aid does not get in a more expedient manner.
Absolutely, which is why Israel has been working and the United States and other countries have been working. The irony is that everybody has been doing somewhat better in the past few weeks. We still are very concerned about several hundred thousand people in North Gaza, but aid is getting into the south in a relatively reasonable flow, about 200 trucks a day. But nonetheless, the other thing you have to think of is, look, if Israel were to stop this war today, as the UN seems to want, and leave Gaza, you would have 2.4 million people in the rubble, ruled by what's left of Hamas, which would simply prepare for another attack on Israel. That's not a future for the Palestinian people, too. This is a very difficult conundrum that President Biden faces, the Israeli face, and we all face. It's not just like Russia, stop fighting in Ukraine and go home and we'll all be happy. That's not the situation here, and it's often presented that way. There are really hard choices here.
Yeah, well, and sir, you mentioned the UN, which, of course, the Security Council passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire just last week. The U.S. did not veto that. It just abstained from the vote. On the subject of a ceasefire, though, we did get a statement from the Israeli Prime Minister's office on behalf of Mossad today that they sent an updated proposal in the hostage release and ceasefire talks that are happening in Cairo. How optimistic are you that if not a permanent ceasefire deal, but a temporary one can be reached in the near term?
Not very. We have seen this movie now for 2 months. Israel, pressed by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, it keeps on coming up with new temporary ceasefire provisions. We endorse them. It goes to Hamas. Hamas says no. The reason is that Hamas looks at the international reaction to blunders like the Israeli attack on the World Central Kitchen and decides we can sit it out. We can demand Israel just leaves, and sooner or later the international community will support us. And I fear that might be right. And that's not a good thing for anybody, not for the Israelis and not for the people of Gaza.
Well, and of course, there are other areas of the Middle East to consider here as well. After yesterday, we got the news that Iran is blaming Israel for striking directly its embassy in Syria, which they say killed two top generals, as well as a number of other Iranian military personnel. Now, Iran's supreme leader is vowing revenge on Israel. He says, this is a quote, Israel will be punished. We will make them regret their crime. How concerned, Ambassador, are you in this moment about escalation, not just between Israel and Hamas, which, of course, is an Iranian proxy, but Israel and Iran directly?
I certainly think the administration is concerned about escalation. But again, we are in a war. Because American forces, be it in the Red Sea, be it in Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, coming under fire and are firing back at times. Escalation is a concern, but there's also a concern of winning, not losing. Israel was struck repeatedly in the last 2 days by Iranian surrogate forces firing weapons made in Iran or given from Iran, including at an Israeli base in Eilat in the south of the country. So Israel sees this as responding. It would be happy to stop shooting at southern Lebanon, to stop shooting at Syria, to stop shooting at Yemen, but they're the people who decided to stop shooting after the 7th of October. That's the problem again. It always seems to come back to, why did Israel do that? Why did Israel escalate? Why does Israel make mistakes? They didn't ask for this fight.
It's great to get your perspective on this, Ambassador. And it's also worth noting, of course, you served as ambassador, not just to Iraq, but Turkey as well. So in our final 90 seconds with you, leaning on that expertise, we did see over this weekend too, Erdogan, the Turkish president, and his party being dealt pretty significant blows in municipal elections. How should we be thinking about what is happening domestically in Turkey and what effect, if any, that could have on the wider balance in the Middle East?
Well, Erdogan did well a year ago in the national elections where he got a new 5-year term as president. And what this shows is that if you have a good leader of the opposition, and that's effectively the candidate for mayor in Istanbul, Mr. İmamoğlu, that the Turkish people are saying, OK, we voted for you. you've been in control for 20 years, but we're unhappy about the economy. We're unhappy about some of your political decisions, particularly the restraint on rights and things like press freedom. So we want to send you a message. It doesn't mean the end of Erdogan. He's still in a powerful position, but it means he has to be careful.
All right, Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us here on Balance of Power. Really great to get your perspective. That's James Jeffrey, former U.S. Ambassador to both Iraq and Turkey, now at the Wilson Center, where he is chair of the Middle East program, joining us today on Bloomberg Television and Radio, where we have much more coming up, because it is not just Israel that we have to have our eye on in terms of geopolitics, but China as well. After President Biden and U.S. President Xi Jinping, or Chinese President Xi Jinping, rather, spoke by phone today, the first time they've talked one-on-one since November. We'll have more on that later this hour. And we're going to talk about abortion rights in Florida next with our political panel right here on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Live from Washington, D.C., where town is still a little bit quiet because a lot of people that are usually here, namely all the members of Congress, aren't here right now. It is still recess or the district work period, whatever you want to call it. And many of them aren't even actually in their districts. A handful of them today are in Florida, including the House Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, who was partaking in a field hearing to discuss the issues of reproductive freedom. This is just a day after Florida's Supreme Court held up the 15-week abortion ban signed by Governor Ron DeSantis back in 2022, which now means a subsequent law which would ban abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, will soon be able to go into effect. But that's not all Florida Supreme Court ruled. They also ruled that a ballot initiative regarding reproductive rights and being enshrined in the Constitution will be on the ballot in November. They are allowing that to go forward. So with more, let's assemble our political panel. Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributor, and Lisa Camuso-Miller, former RNC communications director and host of the Friday Reporter podcast. So Lisa, first to you, what did Florida Supreme Court just do to likely turnout in the state of Florida in November?
Well, Kaylee, they were busy yesterday for sure. And I think that what is interesting to me is that even if Donald Trump is successful in Florida, this decision yesterday is going to make it very difficult for him to thread the needle on this issue. He has said in the past that he's very proud of the fact that the courts have done what they need to do in order to strengthen laws around abortion. But he's also said that he's not in favor of this 6-week ban that has just, or will, excuse me, in 30 days go into place. And so that means that this is really going to be a difficult place to message on an issue that already has been very nuanced for the former president. It also gives a ton of leeway and opportunity for the Democratic ticket to really message about an issue that is absolutely, definitely one that women and families are very adamant about one way or the other.
Yeah, your point is well taken, Lisa, on this being more difficult perhaps for Donald Trump, who my producer James reminded this morning is a resident of Florida. He could potentially be one of the ones who has the ability to vote on this ballot initiative come November. But Jeannie, Florida, now there have been murmurs this morning from some Democratic strategists, could potentially be a different political landscape for Democrats and for President Biden specifically because of the abortion factor. Could abortion being on the ballot actually put Florida in play, make it a swing state once again? Or is it just too red for that to really be true?
Yeah, I think to myself that's a bit of wishful thinking on the part of Democrats. You know, Kaylee, like about 6 months, a year ago, we were hearing that from Democrats. And they said, look, at Florida may be up for grabs, but there is an enormous advantage for Republicans, not only in registration. I think it's about 850,000 more Republicans now in the state than Democrats. They also are so much better organized on the ground, and we've seen that play out in the last couple election cycles. So I'm not sure it puts the state up for grabs. And of course, if that's to happen, Democrats would have to invest money, and we haven't seen evidence of that yet. But I do think, you know, as we look across the country, and we're seeing this in Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, when they're putting abortion on the ballot, One thing we know since the overturning of Roe is every time abortion or reproductive rights has been on the ballot, it has won. And so Democrats are hoping that by putting it on the ballot, even people in the moderate middle who support reproductive rights and who aren't as crazy about Joe Biden or not as sort of incentivized to get out for vote for it, to vote for him, may go out and vote for him because they're energized by this issue. And, you know, it's that issue of getting their voter and their base out that's going to decide this election. So from that perspective, all across the country, they're hoping that this helps them on the Democratic side.
Yeah, Jeannie, you bring up an excellent point about the pattern we've seen in the post-Roe era of what happened in the midterms in 2020 and what has happened in special elections or the like in states since then. Are Democrats, though, over-reliant on the idea of abortion being a galvanizing force, Jeannie, considering that every month we get closer to the election, it's a month further from the actual Dobbs decision and the overturning of Roe?
Yeah, and that's exactly why they are trying to make sure that these issues are on the ballot, to show that, to your point, it's not just something that happened in the past that we can move on from, but it's very much in your state, it's very much local and important to you, and these states may be threatening to restrict these rights. And of course, to, you know, Lisa's point, Donald Trump has sort of been all over the map on the issue of reproductive rights, from, you know, taking credit for overturning Roe to talking about several week swings by which he might want to allow there to be abortion. So it's not a good issue for him. But, you know, the Democrats hope that this is going to, say, not only turn out voters, but sort of get them to vote for Joe Biden. We also haven't seen a lot of evidence of that either. So we have to be careful about that. You know, it was in Florida in 2020. Donald Trump won, but the state also approved the $15 minimum wage, which just tells you that voters in Florida and elsewhere, they can split the baby just like anybody else. They can vote for one thing and something else. So it's not always going to line up like I vote for this ballot measure and I support Joe Biden. They can also support Donald Trump under those circumstances.
Well, Lisa, obviously you have spoken about the difficulty Trump in particular has with this abortion issue, but he's not going to be the only one on the ballot in November. There will be all the down ballot races as well, people vying for congressional seats. Have Republicans writ large figured out how they want to message abortion this election cycle, given everything that Jeannie just said about how much Democrats are leading into this issue?
Oh, no, I don't think anybody's agreed on anything on this issue, Kaylee, at all. But I do think, though, that there are a few things that will actually work in favor. I love how you made the point about Dobbs being every time we get closer to the election, we get further away from the decision. But over the course of time, there have been all of these other actions and activities that have happened that continue to keep the story alive. The issue of IVF, the issue of whether it should be 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 18 weeks. Regardless of all of that, it is incredibly nuanced discussion and incredibly difficult for really any elected official, Republican or Democrat, to talk about unless they are in favor of women's rights, right? And so that makes it very difficult. So it could be that Donald Trump would have one point of view and someone down ballot could have a very different point of view. So it could have an impact on one or another. I think, though, to Jeannie's point, that this for the Democrats, as long as they don't overplay their hand, could very well be the one item and the one issue that does really help with turnout. And that's the one thing that's we're going to continue to talk about between now and November, about how important it is to keep people engaged in the conversation. Because as much as we hear that no one on either side is really thrilled about who the nominee is, that regardless of whoever it is, they are going to have to, the impetus is on them to keep people engaged and get them to the polls in order to support them in order to be successful after Election Day in 24. And so this issue very well could be that issue that drives turnout or keeps people home.
So this is the issue that Democrats seem to be relying on, at least at this point, for that purpose, Lisa. It does seem that for Republicans, that issue is the border. And perhaps we're seeing further evidence of that today when former President Trump is making campaign stops in Michigan and Wisconsin to talk specifically about the border. Is that ultimately the issue that this election is going to be won or lost on, Lisa?
You know, I'm not necessarily sure. I think both of these issues, along with every other issue that relate to the economy, will continue to be the issue that matter the most. Everyone wants to know, who is the candidate that's going to help me, help my family's bottom line, and make sure that I can do everything that I need to do in my daily life through good economic policy. And that, I think, still remains to be the issue. And that's why I think immigration continues to be the one that polls better, that keeps people more engaged, and is one that is absolutely still going to be very much part of the decision going into the voting booth on election day in November. But the one thing, Kaylee, I think we have to keep in mind too, is that Donald Trump is going to eat a little bit of the fact that he stood in the way of bipartisan border policy legislation in the House and the Senate. So that will definitely lay at his feet. And Republicans continue to try to thread the needle regardless. They blame the president, the sitting president, President Biden, on just about everything. I mean, they tried to make the issue where the key bridge went down in Baltimore about an immigration issue. So everyone's going to try to thread that needle every way they can. What's different, though, is that what we're going to need to see out of the mouths of these two candidates is how it is they're going to solve that issue and also deliver on the economy in a way that can make voters feel good about their candidacy and their presidency in 24.
All right, Lisa Camuso-Miller, former RNC communications director and host of the Friday Reporter podcast, together with Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributor. Thank you both.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
About a mile or so down the road, President Biden in the White House today had a pretty important phone call. He spoke one-on-one for the first time with Chinese President Xi Jinping, the first time that's happened since back in November when they had an in-person summit in San Francisco and promised that they would talk more. Perhaps that's exactly why we saw this conversation take place today. And according to the White House, which called their conversation candid and constructive, they talked about a lot of different things: AI risks, efforts on climate change, the U.S. raising concerns with China's support for Russia, issues with unfair trade policies also discussed in this call. It's a lot of ground to cover, and I'm pleased to say we're going to do so now with Sarah Bianchi, former deputy U.S. trade representative in this administration, now senior managing director and chief strategist of international political affairs and public policy at Evercore ISI. So, Sarah, great to have you back. Ambassador, thank you very much for being here on Balance of Power. We know that Biden and Xi had promised they would talk more. They talked more today. I just question what the real tangible outcome of such talks really are.
Well, I think it's important to keep the dialogue going. There are so many things at stake in this relationship for these countries on the issues you mentioned, from climate to trade. There are some really difficult issues right now with China trade, particularly the administration's actions on electric vehicles coming in from China. But there's also some places where there's hope for collaboration, such as climate. President Biden has known Xi for a very, very long time. So I am actually encouraged to see that they're touching base, even if, as you said, there's not real tangible progress.
Well, and of course, this doesn't just happen at this highest level between the two presidents. Cabinet officials have been making their way kind of in rotation to visit China in person as well. The Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, will be doing so later this week, talking about a lot of the economic and trade, as you talk about parts of this relationship. What is most imperative in terms of the economic relationship between these two largest economies in the world right now?
Well, I think a lot of what you're going to see Secretary Yellen talking about is the overcapacity and production in China that is causing risks to the global economy, and also some of the trade practices that we've seen. There's a lot of subsidization of particular industries in the Chinese economy. There's a lot of non-market practices and policies. These are the kinds of things that are going to be on the agenda when Secretary Yellen goes later this week.
Well, and just specifically on trade policy, of course, we saw tariffs implemented during the prior administration, during the Trump administration, and that has not been reversed in this Biden administration. When we think about tariffs and kind of the idea of protectionism overall, is this really only likely to go in one direction from here, which is further protectionism, Sarah?
Well, I think what you've tried to see the Biden administration try and do is to really focus on industries where they are particularly concerned. Semiconductors, AI, things with high technology risk. So you've seen a lot of new actions from the Biden administration on export controls. You have, as you mentioned, seen tariffs kept in place, and that is one policy tool. But I think the Biden administration's notion of small yard high fences requires a whole range of tools, again, export controls, as well as investing in some of our own industries here in the United States.
Well, of course, we're faced, though, with the question of whether we'll still be talking about a Biden administration come January 2025, or if we will once again be talking about a Trump administration. And we have heard a lot from former President Trump, presidential candidate Trump, about what he would like to do in terms of China policy, talking about the prospect of potentially 60% plus tariffs on all Chinese goods, especially when the messaging from the U.S. right now is intentionally that we are not decoupling, diversifying, friendshoring, whatever you want to call it. Could the same be said about what might happen under a future Trump administration, or are tariffs of that level essentially just an outright decoupling?
Well, President Trump has always been enamored of tariffs as a major policy tool, and we very much expect that a second Trump administration would use this tool not only, as you mentioned, with China, where they're talking about particularly high numbers, but also U.S. allies, Europe, Mexico, other places. This is something we saw in the first Trump administration, and we're very have a lot of conviction that it is something we would continue to see. A 60% is a very, very large number. That would certainly have a vast economic inflationary proposals. You could do some of that without the Congress, so it is a real risk. My guess is that they would come down a bit from this number, given the global economic implications, or at least focus it on particular sectors. But we very much believe that a second Trump term would have a lot of tariffs in many sectors and have some very important inflationary impacts to the economy.
Well, many sectors and essentially what you're saying could be many countries as well, not just adversaries like China, but potentially allies too. And on this idea of the way the U.S. handles economically both allies and adversaries, we, of course, have gotten a lot of news within recent weeks about one ally in particular, Japan, and a Japanese company, Nippon Steel, which is trying to buy U.S. Steel. The president, President Biden, has come out against this deal. He's trying to support the United Steel workers. Today, three U.S. senators, including the chair of the Senate Banking Committee, Sherrod Brown, have penned a letter to President Biden calling specifically for the administration to be investigating Nippon's ties and business in China. And I wonder, Sarah, how we should be thinking about this, whether this is kind of a unique case or instead just an example of something more broadly happening here in regard to economic nationalism and U.S. ownership of U.S. companies.
Well, I think it's an interesting, you know, President Biden has had a very, very long-standing relationship with the steelworkers back from his Senate days. He's very... labor is a very important stakeholder to him. He understands those communities, again, given the state he represented and the region of the country. I think what you are seeing in both these candidates is a belief that we really do need to invest in the United States and invest here at home. And they have different approaches to getting at this goal. With Biden, you've seen the Inflation Reduction Act, you've seen the CHIPS Act, infrastructure, really investing in the United States and trying to get, honestly, some foreign investment as well. The South Korea is one of the biggest investors out of the Inflation Reduction Act. With Trump, you see a bit more of tariffs and kind of trying to put a wall, if you will, around the United States. So very, very different approaches, lots of debates about the effectiveness of each, but both these candidates do have one thread. They're very much interested in building here in the U.S.
All right, Ambassador, thank you very much for joining us here on Balance of Power. Sarah Bianchi, of course, former Deputy U.S. Trade Representative and now at Evercore ISI, very much straddling policy and how financial markets should view it.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.